Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke in for Joe Donahue. Joe is scheduled to return on Wednesday, just for your calendar information, if that's something you're keeping track of at home. As you've heard this morning, the lockbox is open. You can keep pledging online at WAMC.org. The total raised so far, and this is, I think, the first time we're announcing the total raised, we have in the lockbox $276,694. A lot of that did come in this morning. Not a majority, but a lot did come in this morning. We're so grateful for everybody, and do keep it going if you will. WAMC.org. While you're on your devices and listening to the roundtable panel conversation, if you would like to email us, that email address is panel@WAMC.org. Music this morning is by Aaron Deal. I want to let you know, by way of forward promotion, at 11 o'clock this morning, we will be airing a Mental Health Month special from American Public Media called Treating the Young Mind. Now, for your panelists for this Monday, Senior Fellow at the Bard Center for Civic Engagement, Jim Ketterer. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Thank you, as ever. Political consultant and lobbyist, Mundi Regulare, Libby Post. Hi, Libby.
Hi.
Good to see you. Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Opinions Her Own, Nick Rangel. Hello, Nick.
Opinions your own. Hi. It's so good to be here. Last night, we're really looking forward to our golf outing coming up July 11th, so keep an eye out for that, but excited to see you on a bright and sunny Monday morning.
Is it sunny? Did the sun come out?
It is kind of sunny. It's windy. Mondays are my favorite day of the week because I might be a crazy person.
Who amongst us?
More so than the other days of the week? Or?
Yeah. Oh. Wait, am I crazier on other days of the week?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good question.
Yeah.
You know, it ebbs and flows. But Monday is my favorite day of the week because you have the best chance of getting your very long to-do list done.
Oh, that is a very
healthy
framing.
It's like the most optimistic day.
Yeah. Okay, that's by Friday, you know you're done.
Yeah. By Friday, you're like, I give up.
Yeah. No,
when's
even
happy
on
hour?
Wednesday,
like
I'm like
noon. I've quit.
Right. Wednesday, I'm like, I might be cooked this week. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know how much more we're getting through. Great. That's a beautifully healthy framing. I'm going to write that down, try to adopt it. Don't feel in my heart it will stick for me, but it's very, very lovely put. Good job, Nick. Let us discuss the latest on the domestic and tax bill, President Trump's one big beautiful bill. This is from the New York Times. Conservatives on the House Budget Committee on Friday blocked their party's mega bill from reaching the floor, citing concerns that the legislation to fulfill President Trump's domestic agenda would add too much to the deficit. It was a remarkable revolt that threatened to upend the party's goal of pushing the legislation through the House before its Memorial Day recess, and it sent Republican leaders scrambling to try to put out the uprising. The setback underscored the treacherous balancing act that Speaker Mike Johnson is trying to pull off. So that was the update on Friday. Last night, the House Budget Committee did revive the stalled bill after those fiscally conservative Republicans relented and allowed it to advance, even as they continued to press for deeper reductions to health and environmental programs. Jim.
Well, like a lot of pieces of legislation, I think it's also useful to get into the details and actually read what's going on in this bill. And there's more in it than just taxes and spending. And so rolled into that is also the closure of the Department of Education, a 25% expansion on logging and national forests, rollback on lots of clean energy initiatives, withdrawing the United States, withdrawing from the Paris Climate Accords, change in pensions for federal employees, and not a change for the better. And on and on and on. So I do think that, you know, with so much going on a minute-by-minute basis and so many crazy things coming out, it really does bear close attention by everybody, including everybody in the listening audience, to pay attention to what's in this bill and what members of Congress are actually going to end up voting on.
Libby?
I'm not surprised that they ended up passing a bill last night. I mean, it was like fun to think of, well, maybe they will stand up and have a backbone, but these are the folks who want even deeper cuts. So we didn't want Michael Johnson and Trump and all the rest of the them capitulating to even more cuts
right.
In all of this. But it was fun while it lasted, and we will see. I think this is going to be a I don't think it's going to be as easy as everyone thinks it's going to be to pass it ultimately in either house, but we shall see. You know, there are Republicans, especially in the Senate, that don't like what's going on. Will probably
You're
be
off mic. Sorry. Huh? You were off mic just there for a second.
They don't like what's going on. They'll probably, you know, not run again, but will be able to do something with any luck. But let's be honest here. If this budget goes through, and I think that this has always been the modus operandi of this administration and these people and their ilk, people are going to die. And for them, that means less public assistance, because the people who are going to die are going to be poor people, and they really do not care about that. And children are already dying because of RFK Jr. and his ridiculousness about vaccinations. And there's more, you know, folks, there are more kids in Texas with measles than there are transgender athletes in the entire country. So let's really focus on what needs to be taken care of. It's not the hysteria over trans athletes. It's really public health. That's what needs to be dealt with. This administration does not care about public health, and we're going to see some stuff that we never thought. Those of us of my age group, and maybe even Jim's age group, never ever thought possible in this country. But that's where we're headed.
Nick?
Yeah, so I actually want to talk a little bit about the changes to the Medicaid program.
Yep.
Because it's estimated that 8 to 13 million Americans would be kicked off of Medicaid. And the reason I want to bring this up is that I relied on Medicaid for most of my young adult life. And some things I learned along the way was that New York State adds and contributes a substantial amount to expand Medicaid coverage to people here in New York, and other states make different choices. They either can contribute or expand their Medicaid coverage or expand what's available or not. And so at that time, I had lived in New York State, and then I moved to Colorado, where Colorado does not have as expansive of a Medicaid program. And this is these changes are important because the changes would require childless adults who are income eligible for Medicaid to work at least 80 hours a month to qualify. And one might think, well, 80 hours a month, it's not that much, right? But I was a full-time student. I had three jobs. They weren't all on the books. And I would have had to prove in some capacity how I was completing those tasks, right? So
right.
If you're babysitting under the table, how do you prove that you worked 80 hours in a month? I was a volunteer firefighter. That doesn't count. I was an EMT. That doesn't count. I trained people on Swiftwater Rescue. That wouldn't have counted. So
Are you a Paw Patrol?
How
are you doing all of these jobs?
So you know, there's so much contribution that a person makes in their community. As a student, I was on, you know, the student association. I was like the president of everything because that's just who I was born to be. And these things don't count. And then I had back surgery. I had a massive spinal fusion at the age of 26. It blew through all of my insurance, and then I was unemployed because I had no concept of how long I would be disabled from that spinal fusion. And I had to go back to work really early in a back brace and with sutures because in Colorado, their Medicaid coverage just did not expand and extend, and I wasn't qualified for enough other kinds of benefits. Like, and I'm a person who's just, you know, kind of started working when I was 14. So you have to think about who are the most vulnerable people in this situation. They will not be able to prove or achieve these new goals. So even if you could say, well, they could work 80 hours a week, they're going to lose coverage if they can't prove they tried, if they can't get the job that meets the qualifications, if they can't get to an office, physically to an office to turn in the paperwork that's required. These are substantial changes. They look like they're just working around the edges and cutting down on fraud, but that's not the case. There are going to be millions of people who just lose coverage overnight because they just can't achieve the requirement of turning in that paperwork. And we have to be really, really thoughtful and careful about what that means for adults, particularly places where we have measles outbreaks and other contagious diseases where you need to have access to healthcare. Anyway, that's my soapbox.
It is such a specific and complicated issue. Just Medicaid or just Medicare, for it all to be in one bill feels fairly absurd.
Yeah. Yes. Another thing.
Well,
that's
the savings. It's because of the cost savings. If there are 12 million people who are on Medicaid right now who are eligible, right? These are people who meet all the qualifications, and then you just tinker on the edges and you make it just a teensy weensy bit harder to keep that eligibility. It's already hard. And it's already hard in rural and remote communities where transportation is expensive and challenging and difficult and impossible sometimes, right? If you just make it a little bit harder, these people just fall off. And mm-hmm. those are savings. Those are savings that are going to people who make over $400,000 a year in their household income.
That's what this is all about. It's all about cutting these programs so the rich can get their tax cuts.
Well, that is. I mean,
it's just that simple.
The bill is seeking to find these savings in order to pay for the tax cuts.
Right, to finance the tax cuts.
For wealthy people.
Yeah.
I think the bill is also in line with many of the other things that the Trump administration is doing, which is to further enhance the overall power of the executive branch. One of the other things that's in this bill enhances the president's impoundment powers. That means that even when the Congress finalizes a bill and the president signs it, and it says that X amount of money is going to go to Y program, that after that fact, after that piece of legislation is passed and signed, the president can say, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to impound that money. We're going to unilaterally decide outside of the scope of this process, as messy and as adversarial as it is actually the process, that this would circumvent that. And the president would have more powers under this bill to impound that money willy-nilly.
Janet writes in to panel at WAMC.org and says, Section 112209 of the bill would allow the executive branch to revoke the tax-exempt status of nonprofits labeled terrorist-supporting organizations without requiring due process or review of evidence. What would that mean for the millions of people who are served by those nonprofits and for those who have donated to, quote, terrorist-supporting organizations?
Well, legal aid might be considered terrorist. Well, the LGBT centers will be considered terrorists.
I think actually they're focused on organizations that support Palestinians.
That's very much so true. Yep,
because
probably.
Legal aid, almost all of our dollars comes from grants that are issued by government agencies. So we're already in compliance with the statutes and the regulations that control the dollars that we spend. The government hires us to enforce the laws that the government itself has been unable to do on its own, right? Like we appeal DSS decisions and SSA decisions. Those are government agencies, and then we get paid by the government to enforce the law that the agency has, rejected in some way. It's sort of a funny, anyway. But I think that this bill, I think that legislation is focused on the organizations that raise unrestricted cash for the purpose of supporting Palestinians.
Well, I think if it's not defined, I don't know exactly what it says in the bill about that. But if they don't define terrorism, it can mean one thing one day and something else another day. And so it could start with groups that are supporting Palestinian rights and move on to other things once it's enshrined in law. That's dangerous. I would say a couple things about this. One, it is right out of an authoritarian playbook to clamp down on nonprofits. And so in other countries that I've worked in, it has been a major source of the push of authoritarian regimes to clamp down on them, to regulate where they get their money from, how they can spend their money, how it's governed, et cetera. So it's not surprising that this is happening. And on the Palestinian issue, number one, I mean, it bears repeating. One can support Palestinian rights without supporting Hamas. One can support the State of Israel without supporting the Netanyahu government.
That's right.
And but it does bear repeating over and over and over again, because these things all get conflated in a way that makes it easy to clamp down on organizations for purely political reasons.
Jim Ketterer, it's time for a break, Nick, sorry. Jim Ketterer is our panel, Libby Post, Nick Rangel. You can join the conversation by emailing us, panel@wamc.org. The lockbox is open, and David Gustina and Ray Graff will tell you more about that after this underwriting break.
1-800-323-9262. I'm Ray Graff. David Gustina, it's only going to be a couple of minutes here before we go back to the panel, but important things going on. What are they?
They are the lockbox challenge. We have opened the lockbox this morning, and we're asking you to put something in so we can knock off time of the regular drive, which starts on air Monday, June 2nd. We need all of you now. And if you think about it like one of our sprints, we've got under 5 minutes to go. Ray and I trying to get a little bit more, just a little bit more into this lockbox by reminding you that this world is filled with noise, but WAMC is your rare source of fact-based, thoughtful journalism. You hear it every morning on Morning Edition, Midday Magazine, All Things Considered, Northeast Report, Late Edition. All of it because we believe in the power of information and the journalism of verification, and so do you. So right now, head to WAMC.org or just call 1-800-323-9262 and put something in, and we will get this fun drive done as quickly as possible to cover the important real-world events of the day.
Every gift right now will save us time during the drive, and it could be a one-day drive. It could be less than that, 800-323-9262. But in a very real sense, it sends a message that this radio station, WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, matters. It matters to you. It matters to the community. Where else are you going to have a discussion that sometimes is an hour and 45 minutes, sometimes is 2 hours, every day, about events and news items and things that are important to all of us? Where else are you going to find that? It's not a commercially really a savvy move for a commercial station to do that. This is a station, because it is listener supported, we can do things that commercial stations just can't. It doesn't fit in their business model. We care about our community. We care about you. We care about doing the best we can for you. You, us, we are a team. 800-323-9262, and we could not do it without you. WAMC.org. Dave, we only have 2 minutes here before we go back to the roundtable panel, but this is an important thing. Filling that lockbox right now. The drive starts in 2 weeks. Hopefully it's a day. Hopefully it's, you know, 30 seconds and it's over. You make it possible. Don't make a pledge if you can't do it. If you can do it, $1 gets you in, $5, $100, whatever you want to do. And yeah, there are premiums, Dave, that are, you hit a certain level between 60 and 100 or a little more. You can get whatever you want. WAMC has swag. But it's really, that's not what it's about.
2 minutes on the dot to get as much as we can in that lockbox before we go back to the panel discussion. Think about it. We have panel discussions every day, as Ray mentioned. We give you the news not only from NPR, but the Beeb, the Marketplace, all of these sources that come to you to provide a wider view of the world, something larger than your own experience. But together, we all experience WAMC, and you are the shareholders of this company. You are the ones that support us, that keep us alive. You're the ones that tell us you can't live without us. So right now at 1-800-323-9262 or WAMC.org is where we need you to live. We need you to put something in, and we will show everyone out there the importance of public media. No matter what's happening in Washington, we have you, our incredible, amazing, loyal WAMC audience, and it's been an experience for all of us together that we don't want to end. WAMC.org, 1-800-323-9262. Ray Graff.
WAMC.org to make your pledge, or you can call. We do have volunteers here, which is amazing here on a Monday morning. 800-323-9262. We're going back to the roundtable in about 40 seconds. But remember this. There's a lot of noise out there. Some of it's on the radio. Some of it's in real life. Some of it's on your TV. There's a lot of noise. What WAMC is, that rare source of clarity, of fact-based, thoughtful journalism, of ideas that are shared, sometimes disagreed with, sometimes agreed with, but bandied about and discussed. And this is a place like no other on the dial. Got to be honest with you. If you want to keep it, we need you. 800-323-9262, WAMC.org to make your secure online pledge. David, let's go back to the roundtable.
Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. Thank you to Ray Graff and David Gustina for that locked box push and update. We appreciate it. The website, WAMC.org. You can join the conversation by emailing us, panel@WAMC.org. And our panel this morning, Jim Ketterer, Libby Post, and Nick Rengel. We are going to pick it up right where we left it because Nick's memory allows for her to know what she was going to say before the break. Hey, Nick, what were you going to say?
You know, we've had like three other conversations, too, in between. Sure. Well, I just wanted to circle back on sort of some of the conceptual targets of the statutory change around repealing or revoking tax-exempt status. I know that there's a lot of concern around people or organizations that work in immigration issues, particularly issues related to the undocumented population. So I think in addition to the groups that work in the Palestinian space, the groups that are working in the undocumented space are deeply concerned about that legislation particularly. And I think because there's been a lot of rhetoric around what the legality is of providing resources to a person who is undocumented, and if there is some argument that engagement or that activity is illegal. And, you know, we saw the arrest of multiple judges on that argument. And so there is a real fear, and there's a lot of conversation around what would that sort of nebulous discussion like turn into, particularly in that legislation that people should be aware of.
John writes in to panel@WAMC.org and says, so let me get this straight. The right wing constantly dredges up, quote, what Obama did, unquote, vis-a-vis rejecting applications for tax-exempt status. But the right wing is perfectly fine revoking tax-exempt status for whoever they don't like. Yes, Libby is 1,000% correct. This will be used to go after LGBTQAI+ organizations once they get done with any group that is even remotely vaguely positive about the Palestinians. Speaking of Gaza and the Palestinians and Israel, let us get an update on that. This is from the AP. The war in the Gaza Strip has reached one of its darkest periods, and that is, of course, really saying something. Israel has cut off all food and supplies to the territory nearly 3 months ago. The military has launched another major offensive against Hamas, including extensive ground operations. Hundreds of people in the Palestinian territory have been killed in recent days. Experts have warned a looming famine. Doctors say overwhelmed hospitals are running out of medicine to treat even routine conditions. Israel on Sunday said it would allow a, quote, basic amount of food into Gaza so a hunger crisis wouldn't jeopardize its new military operation, but there were no immediate details. The military is preparing for a new organization with U.S. backing to take over aid delivery, despite alarms raised by humanitarian groups that say the plans won't meet the massive need and could weaponize food assistance. It's unclear when operations would begin or who would fund them. So a promise of some relief in the Gaza Strip that is... seems like a lot of details need to be worked out. Jim?
Yeah, my question overall on the military side is, what is the end game? What is the goal that Israel is hoping to achieve militarily now in the Gaza Strip? And secondly, what's the broader political end game? And what is an end game that would be to the advantage of not just the people who are in immediate humanitarian crisis in the Gaza Strip, but for that we were talking before about Palestinian rights, but also Israel and the safety and security of the state of Israel. And I haven't seen any kind of compelling argument to say that what's going on now is going to be to the advantage of any of those constituencies. And so in the absence of that, you just have this perpetual cycle of crisis and violence and slight kind of, you know, lifting of restrictions and then back into a cycle of crisis and violence. And this doesn't really serve the ends of anyone, including the United States. It's bears noting that when Donald Trump was in the Middle East, that Israel and Gaza were not part of the conversation. And, you know, what is the role of the United States under the Trump administration in all of this? The Trump administration got all kinds of credit for being able to help facilitate the ceasefire when it happened. But it does appear that that ceasefire was done with a kind of a nod and a wink to say, like, well, you know, once this is over, then Israel will have a green light to carry out these kinds of activities that we now see. And we shouldn't also lose sight of what's going on in the West Bank, which is also extremely dangerous. And I think also doesn't have any kind of end game that is helpful for Palestinians or the state of Israel. So there's a lot of open questions. There's an immediate humanitarian crisis, and the role of the United States, I think, is really unclear now.
Nick?
I mean, it seems like the one of the, I guess, options here is that by bringing the Palestinians on the brink of death by starvation, that there may be more leverage to get other countries to start accepting those Palestinians as refugees in a way that they've not had access to in the last several years. Because, you know, it's this imagery and these discussions around, like, at what level of risk are people at? And we know that thousands of people have already died from starvation through this approach. And I do think Israel is just hoping and waiting for the doors to open elsewhere so they can move those people out, so they can take over those boundaries. I mean, that is the end. That's the stated end goal, is to have control over that land and also the West Bank as part of Israel. And they can't do that if the Palestinians are still there.
Well, I mean, I would just say, so there are people on the Israeli cabinet who have made that a stated end goal. That is certainly not an end goal that is supported by many Palestinians. It's not an end goal that's supported by many Israelis also. That, what you just described, and what some members of the Israeli cabinet have said about the West Bank, and particularly Gaza, would constitute ethnic cleansing. And so this would be, and even if you made the situation so unlivable and then tried to wrap a humanitarian bow around it to say, well, we're doing this for humanitarian reasons, that would still be ethnic cleansing. And that is, you know, constitutes a crime against humanity. And so that's really simply unacceptable. In addition, it would not solve the overall crisis, and it wouldn't end the situation that Israel finds itself in. It doesn't solve the problem in addition to all the other things that I just said. So, you know, the rumors that people would be moved into Sinai and the Egyptian side, or they'd be, lots of people would be sent to Libya, or on and on and on. No matter how it's presented, mm-hmm. This is beyond problematic.
Nick, you made big eyes while Jim was talking. Do you want to respond?
No, I mean, yes, that is what that would be called.
Ethnic cleansing.
But I don't see...
It's not
see,
just called. I mean, it would, like, that meets
it
the
would
legal
meet that
definition. Yeah.
Right. But that doesn't mean it isn't what's occurring.
Exactly. Yeah, I agree.
Libby?
Well, you know, I'm a little conflicted a little, not a lot, but a little. I mean, in 1948, none of those Arab countries that surrounded Israel, and there were many of them, they have much more land, agreed to take in any of the Palestinians that were in what is now Israel. So that's from a historical perspective. And they've refused to do that up until today, really. I mean, not like they should have. But the other part of this is, and it's very perplexing, but also really sort of difficult to talk about as a Jew, that I support Israel's right to exist. I will always support Israel's right to exist. But just like I don't support the government in this country right now, I do not support the government in Israel. I think that it's been taken over by the furthest right-wing reaches of the Hasidic and Haredi communities. And it's just what they're doing is just going to perpetuate the hate. It's just going to give more reason for people in this country to act out on their anti-Semitism, because, you know, you can say, oh, it's really anti-Zionism, but then, you know, kids get beat up at school for being Jewish. So it's, you know, there's a direct link between what has happened in the last year and a half, 2 years in the United States since October 7th and the rise in anti-Semitism. That you can't, you know, you can't make that distinction anymore. But this government, this Netanyahu government, has to be stopped. And, you know, it's a parliamentary kind of government, right? And so someone's going to have to pull the plug to say we need new elections. And Netanyahu's certainly not going to do it, because he's as power hungry as Trump is. He's smarter than Trump, but he is as power hungry, and knows that if he ends up not being the prime minister, he'll end up in jail. So he's trying to protect his own skin. And the Palestinians are the ones who are paying the price here. There's no two ways about it. The fact that they're just now starting to let in, you know, aid, and they weren't letting in aid before, it flies in the face of Jewish values. It just does. You know, we're supposed to welcome the stranger. You know, read the Old Testament. There's all of this in there. Welcoming the old stranger, treating them well, you know, all of this, treating your neighbor well, helping people who are in distress, all of it. And they've lost their way, as far as I'm concerned, in the state of Israel. Not the majority of people, because I think the majority of people want this over with. They want peace. They don't see why there can't be some way of forging a peace. Whether that can now happen, because what I don't think they really understand in the Israeli cabinet is what they are doing now is just going to grow more homegrown terrorists. It's just that simple. The hate, the anger, it's just going to multiply, and we're going to just keep repeating this scenario over and over and over again.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. Our panel this morning, Jim Ketterer, Libby Post, and Nick Rangel. We will return after this short break. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke, in for Joe Donahue. The WAMC lockbox is open, and you can pledge anytime at WAMC.org. Our panel this morning, Jim Ketterer, Libby Post, and Nick Rangel. Join the conversation by emailing us at panel@WAMC.org. I did not expressly include this in our topics, but I am confident that, Jim, you can speak to the question I'm going to ask you. You mentioned in your last comments that President Donald Trump was in the Middle East last week, having a fantastic time by all accounts, but did not attend to this, terrible situation in Israel and Gaza and the West Bank. Do you find that to be irresponsible of the president?
Well, I mean, aside from the irresponsibility of the current president, I mean, there is a long history of American administrations working with other of the Arab states and trying to set up deals that are separate from the Israel-Palestinian issue. And that has worked sometimes. And Jimmy Carter and the Camp David Accords was supposed to include the Palestinians at some level, but essentially it became a bilateral agreement between Israel and Egypt. And there have been other times when there has really been a serious effort to kind of de-link the Israel-Palestine issue from other sets of relationships that the U.S. has around the Middle East. So I saw what President Trump was doing on his most recent trip as part of that. I mean, the spectacle of the trip and the, you know, all that went into it was another order of magnitude. But to your specific question, it's not the first time that this has happened. Donald Trump is not the first American president who has been doing these kinds of things. And and I think in many ways has found willing partners from many of the leaders of the Arab states as well.
Since you have expertise in the region, is there anything you want to talk about Trump's visit to Saudi Arabia last week?
Well, one thing that I think is that bears noting is that many of the things in the stream of press releases that came from the White House and that were being taken credit for on this trip, many of them apparently were contracts that had already been signed during the Biden administration. And so, again, you know, not the first president to take credit for something that a previous president had done, but he does it with a certain kind of special flair, I guess. Yeah, exactly. and so, you know, some of it was really over the top. I mean, the whole airplane thing and Qatar, this is just crazy. And then, you know, all of the mixing of American foreign policy with the personal business of the Trump family and the Trump deals around the region. You know, it happened to be taking place in the Middle East on this trip. That's not the only place in the world that we see this mixing of private business and public policy with this administration. But you really saw it on just massive display on this trip. And, you know, it seems that the leaders of Saudi Arabia, of the Emirates, and of Qatar really have a sense on how to flatter the president in a way that, to be most effective. And just to see it on display was impressive in its own kind of crazy way.
It's really something. And, you know, their pockets are being lined. I mean, their pockets are being filled with money, right? Filled with money. And as long as he keeps up the drumbeat at home about immigrants and their drug dealers and their murderers and people of color are bad and all of this sort of stuff, his base doesn't care because he's still talking to them about race and division, and that's what they want. And they don't care about whether his pockets are being lined.
Yeah, and foreign policy. And they don't get it either. And foreign policy doesn't usually get a lot of attention,
right, foreign policy,
anyway.
Right. It's only us UN kid nerds, right?
Yeah, right.
UN club kid nerds that care about the foreign policy.
I'm guilty as charged. Definitely yeah. A nerd. One other thing, though, that that wasn't discussed, at least publicly, that I saw on this trip, was the situation in Yemen and with Yemen. And so we've had an American shooting war with the Houthis mm-hmm. in Yemen. It started during the Biden administration. It actually started well before with some of the other Gulf states who were engaged in this conflict and supported by the United States, including giving some advanced weaponry to carry out this war. There has been really no calling to account as to the effectiveness of these conflicts. You know, the Houthis are trying to stop ships moving through this very tight space, and this is access to the Persian Gulf, it's access to the Mediterranean, access through the Suez Canal. I mean, it's hugely important. That's true, but we have been spending billions of dollars. We've had a fair number of our advanced drones shot down by the Houthis. We lost two advanced fighter jets that fell off the decks of our aircraft carriers. This is a serious naval engagement for the United States. And although the signal chat, the group chat, got all kinds of attention, the actual conflict and what is going on, and that we have people in harm's way, and that Yemen is in the midst of a horrible humanitarian crisis. You have children starving to death there. And there are many people caught in the middle of this conflict who are really, really suffering. It's maybe it's hard to win this prize, this unfortunate prize, but it might be the worst humanitarian crisis on the planet right now. It's getting zero attention, and it certainly wasn't brought up on this trip that was all about spectacle and flattery.
Well, again, it's the other, right?
Yeah.
It's the other.
Nick?
Well, I agree totally that there is not enough attention being brought to the crisis there, and that there's sort of an intentional absence of that discussion or in the airwaves. But I don't know. It wouldn't have benefited the administration to bring attention to that particular conflict and that crisis. And so just on a political plane, it kind of makes sense, right?
Yeah, but I would say at the same time that we're undercutting our ability to provide humanitarian assistance, and we did away with the U.S. Agency for International Development, and we're also undercutting our ability to carry out serious and professional diplomacy, and that's what's really required. So a presidential trip to the Gulf region, one would hope, would then be the beginning point of spurring on the only thing that's really going to help Yemen right now and help the situation, which is a regional diplomatic agreement on how to deal with Yemen and the Houthis, that's not just us, not just Israel, but also includes the Saudis and the Emiratis and the Omanis and others. And as far as I can tell, that hasn't happened and isn't happening. And so we're just, you know, engaging in a shooting war with no real plan.
I mean, it seems to me that this administration has sort of divorced the notion that diplomacy goes hand in hand with economic development, that the administration doesn't see those two as needing to be as interwoven as maybe past administrations had, and that had been kind of traditional as part of our soft power. We've kind of said we really don't care that much about the soft power. We kind of just want to focus on the economic development. From my perspective, the whole trip was about making deals and having these economic opportunities, and how do you, you know, engage in that way, and less about the diplomacy. And I think, you know, there were very few conversations that would like normalize relations in a broader sense beyond the economic opportunities.
I would just note, too, that the person who coined the term soft power, Joseph Nye, who was at one point the dean of the Kennedy School at Harvard, he just recently passed away. And, you know, what you just described, Nick, this interweaving of various interests and elements of our projection of foreign policy, that's really the way that it should work. Military might and diplomacy and commerce and all of it working together. And Joseph Nye analyzed that and described it very, very well. And it seems that as he's passed away, that the world that he was part of is also passing away.
Desiree wrote into panel at WAMC.org and says, I like to remind people that the Israeli people are not Netanyahu and Palestinians are not Hamas. That's from Desi. Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. Our panel this morning, Jim Ketterer, Libby Post, and Nick Rangel. We will return with more of the roundtable panel after a newscast from Ian Pickus and a little bit more information about the lockbox from Ray and David after this.
A graph, yes. And we are tasked. We said to us, listen, we're opening the lockbox. You guys are going to bring in some money. You're going to talk to the listeners. You're going to convince them that the way to do this fund drive is to get that money in the lockbox before the June 2nd on-air drive so that we can end the thing quickly. We can show that together we are going to keep WAMC uninterrupted despite the situation in Washington with the federal money. And right now, Raymond, in our lockbox, we have $277,078, already
277K?
Yeah.
Today?
Well, I mean, I think it's come in over the transom, but
that's beautiful. Well,
apparently, I've heard we've made some money today. 1-800-323-9262, WAMC.org. And I know you have people to thank.
We do indeed. And just remember, you have heard about efforts to defund and destabilize funding for public media, and it could be a serious challenge. But thanks to people like you, all of our listeners, our members, our underwriters, this mission will not be interrupted. Journalism, trusted journalism, cultural connection, community service, all uninterrupted, but we do need you. 800-323-9262. We will be going back to the roundtable panel very shortly. This is a brief break. Thanks to Anonymous in Bearsville, New York. Thanks to Roberta in New York, New York, who says thanks to the gardeners and Ray for the gardening show. Many other things on the air are great, too, but that's pretty wonderful. Roberta, thank you. Thanks to Carol in Albany, New York. Thanks to Anonymous in Mechanicville, New York. Nancy in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. 800-323-9262. Join the parade, folks. WAMC.org. You can make a secure online pledge. Thanks to Anonymous in South Hadley, Massachusetts. Christina in Enfield, Connecticut, who says, way to go. Keep it up. We love you. And we're right back at you, Christina.
Yeah, you know, we could make it to 300,000 this morning if everyone who's listening right now just did a little tiny something. You know, it doesn't take $1,000 to help this radio station run. If you can give a dollar, $5, $10, it all counts. It's all about the public and public broadcasting. And if you can't afford it, if you're going through a rough time, Ray makes this point all the time. I'm going to make it again. That is, don't. There are so many folks here who will pick you up in a time of need, and if you get to a point where you can give more, then you do it at another time. But what we want is people who can give something, who can support us, and who can say, we are not going to lose this community, this Northeast WAMC, United States of WAMC, that has provided a perspective on our region like no other public broadcasting entity. You have done it year after year since 1979, and this year may be the most important. 1-800-323-9262, WAMC.org is how to do it. Together, we will continue WAMC uninterrupted.
We only have about a minute here before we go back to the panel, and we will not go too far here. This is a lockbox. This is tremendous progress in a lockbox. We have already shortened the fund drive, and we're going to keep doing that. This is more than fundraising. It is about protecting one of the last truly independent sources of news on the radio. And may I say, not just news, independent programming, independently produced. You are the backing behind the whole thing. You're the shareholders here. 800-323-9262. We're not going to let this be taken away. This is our thing. You, us, all of us. 800-323-9262, WAMC.org. David, say something, and then we'll go back to Studio A.
Can't thank everyone enough who's done something already. If you haven't, be a part of this morning. The lockbox is open at WAMC.org. Back to the roundtable.
Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke in for Joe Donahue. Our panel this morning, Senior Fellow at the Bard Center for Civic Engagement, Jim Ketterer, Political Consultant and Lobbyist, Libby Post, and Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel. The lockbox is open, as you've just heard, WAMC.org, and you can also email us, panel@WAMC.org. Jim, you're participating in an event that will be moderated by one of my colleagues. Let us preview that for the people.
Yeah, so tomorrow night.
Wait, your mic is not on or something.
No.
Try again.
Okay.
Thank you.
Tomorrow night, Tuesday, I'm going to be on a panel, part of an event with the New York Civil Liberties Union Albany area. And it's at Albany Law School, 5:30. Congressman Paul Tonko is also part of the event, the president of UAlbany, Javidan Rodriguez, Charles Hogel, who is an attorney with the ACLU, will be there. And I'll be there talking about foreign policy, et cetera. It's a few days beyond Trump's 100 days, but it's going to be looking back at the first 100 days. Where do things stand? Where do we think things are going? The kind of stuff we're talking about here on the roundtable as well. But hopefully people can show up and hear what we all have to say. And your colleague, Aaron Shallow Levine.
WAMC's Southern Adirondack Bureau Chief.
Yeah, he's going to be the moderator, so he's going to be keeping us all in line. Tough task, but I'm sure he's up to it.
Of course he is. Shallow can do anything. Do you know where you can learn more about that? Sorry to put you on the spot. Is there a webpage, or maybe you could find it?
So I think I've seen them advertising it on social media, and there is a way to register for it just so they know how many people are coming, and there'll be an opportunity for people in the audience to ask questions if they so choose, and a reception following the event. So, as I said, 5:30 Albany Law School, and if you look up New York Civil Liberties Union Capital Region, you can find them somewhere advertising it.
Great. Thank you. Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation this morning. There was a big election in Romania. Let's talk about that. In a setback for Europe's surging nationalist forces, Nicușor Dan, a centrist mayor and former mathematics professor on Sunday, won the presidential election in Romania, defeating a hard-right candidate who is aligned with President Trump and has opposed military aid to Ukraine. With more than 98% of ballots counted, preliminary official results gave a 54% of the vote in the presidential runoff to Mr. Dan, 55, the mayor of Romania's capital, Bucharest. His opponent, George Simion, a nationalist and fervent admirer of Mr. Trump, who had widely been seen as the front runner, drew only 46%. Big election in Romania. Jim.
Well, you know, after Canada and then Australia, now Romania, it appears that the magic Trump touch is for the people who are in opposition to Trump. And so that's an interesting trend, and it'll be interesting to see where else it plays out. I also just wanted to mention that multiple times over the years, I have participated in election observation missions through the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. It's a mouthful. And it doesn't sound like something that the United States would be a member state of, but we are. And the U.S. has sent delegations to these election observation missions. And it's an important function of not only being a member state of that, but being a member state of countries that care about elections and democracy. Well, it seems that the Trump administration has decided that the U.S. will not be sending delegations to these observation missions. And so there wasn't one in Romania, as far as I know, and they're not recruiting people to be part of any of these other elections. And so I just think that's probably not on people's radar screens, but it's the kind of thing that gets lost in the haze when we see an election in one of these countries that we normally would have been there and been part of, and now we're not. We've just decided to absent ourselves from it. And so these Romanian results made me think of it. One other thing about Romania specifically is that the nationalist, populist leader who lost this election is now saying the election was rigged.
Gee.
And that people should get out into the streets and protest this. And it remains to be seen what kind of protests there will be, if violence will be used. But this all seems to be part of the playbook.
Nick?
Yeah, I guess I wonder if, you know, I want to kind of just separate, you know, whether or not this is a reflection on our president and maybe reflect on sort of what's going on near Romania, having nothing to do with our administration, but having to do with the invasion of Russia into Ukraine and the way our country has sort of changed its rhetoric around that invasion and what that might feel like for people in Romania who are so close to that conflict. And, you know, the changing relationship between our country and Europe, the European Union, and even within the UN. And just, you know, I think the voters in Romania are maybe starting to think differently about how it reflects and whether it does reflect American priorities, or if it's thinking more about its own priorities as part of Europe.
I would just, you know, I think that's a good point. It's a very good point about the situation in Ukraine and people in Romania and other parts of that part of Europe feeling potentially threatened if Russia is allowed to benefit from its aggression in Ukraine, and then what happens next. And it, you know, it's worth remembering what Romanians went through, that they were part of the Soviet sphere, and they had one of the nastiest dictators, Nicolae Ceausescu, who oversaw Romania. And so Romanians who are old enough to remember that certainly don't want to go back to that experience. And the extent to which the U.S., under the Trump administration, appearing, it's not so clear these days, but certainly early on in the administration, appearing to give the green light to the Russians to benefit from their aggression in Ukraine, that would certainly scare many people in and around Romania.
You have to wonder whether or not Trump will say, sure, Vlad, take another one, because you're taking Ukraine, and here's another piece of your country that was that left and is you want back as part of the motherland. So if he is if Putin is successful in Ukraine, I think we're going to see more of these incursions.
You know, the U.S., I'm sorry to cut you off, but I'll forget this otherwise. The U.S. ambassador to Ukraine just resigned. And she resigned, I mean, not just like right now, but in the past few days. And she, in her resignation, she said that peace at any price is appeasement. And we've learned that lesson in the past and apparently have forgotten it. But I am sure the Romanians have not forgotten that.
We have forgotten a lot of the lessons from the past.
So it seems.
And again, and I've said this over and over again, there's no more World War II veterans in Congress to remind people what fighting fascism was all about.
Nick?
Well, and so Romania is a member of NATO. We, you know, have this sort of changing relationship to NATO and what our involvement looks like. But we also know that Russia is adding armaments and military capacity on the border of Finland, and that there's some concern about what the purpose of those armaments are. And I just, you know, I think that there's a looming threat that could be causing some anxiety among voters in Romania, and I think also Poland has had an election this weekend as well, and are seeing this shift away from prioritizing nationalism towards prioritizing something else, which may be its own security as a nation.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation, speaking, as we very often are, of Ukraine and President Volodymyr Zelensky, and of course Russia and President Vladimir Putin. Putin is scheduled to have a call any time now, any time this morning, with President Donald Trump. And this weekend, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky met with top U.S. officials. We had talked about how that was going to happen on Friday, and of course it did happen, and European leaders on Sunday in Rome ahead of the high-stakes call happening this morning. The discussions came as Russia launched what Ukraine called its largest drone barrage against Ukraine since the start of its full-scale invasion in 2022, after the first direct talks between Moscow and Kyiv in recent years failed to yield a ceasefire on Friday. Zelensky spoke with Vice President J.D. Vance and Secretary of State Marco Rubio at the U.S. ambassador's residence after attending the inaugural mass for Pope Leo in St. Peter's Square. Zelensky said on social media that he had underscored the need for, quote, real diplomacy, unquote, and reaffirmed Ukraine's commitment to a, quote, full and unconditional ceasefire, end quote. Zelensky also met with the new pope after mass and said, quote, the authority and voice of the Holy See can play an important role in bringing this war to an end, end quote. The Ukrainian president had written that on social media, and he thanked the Vatican for its readiness, to become a platform for direct negotiations between Ukraine and Russia. So the church is involved. Jim.
Yeah, I think it's worth us remembering what the stakes are, you know, in Ukraine itself. And so, you know, the Russians attacked a sovereign state. So there is that, and in the way that Nick was just talking about, you know, the message that is sent to other parts of Europe, what does that really mean for the part of the NATO Charter, Article 5, that says that if one is attacked, that everyone else has to come to their defense? By the way, the only time that has been invoked is in support of the United States after 9/11. And many other NATO countries did come to our defense and work with us going forward. But there's real concern in Europe that Article 5 is just now kind of a nice idea, and the U.S. would not be behind really defending them should it come to that. So that's always in the background of this. And in Ukraine itself, you know, you have just over the last few days, you have Russia unleashing waves of attacks, of drone attacks, targeting civilian locations. You have, through the course of this war since 2022, you have many war crimes that have been committed and documented. You have thousands and thousands of Ukrainian children that have been abducted and moved from Ukraine into Russia. You have territory that has been taken, and within that territory, sexual assault weaponized as a war crime. You know, it is a bleak situation, to put it mildly, massive deaths on both sides. So for sure, there needs to be a serious diplomatic engagement to come to a ceasefire, but also, as I was saying before, to come to a just and sustainable peace and to not allow Russia to benefit from their aggression, from their war crimes, and also to negotiate what is going to be the future of Ukraine, what's its relationship with the West going to be, with NATO, what's the future going to be with those children who have been abducted, and on and on and on. You know, the devil is in the details. And just saying from Washington, well, we want to have peace and we're going to have a phone call with Putin and we're going to sort this all out in this transactional kind of way, without attending to the details and just going for the press release that says we now have peace, that's not nearly enough.
Well, so I think what's kind of been interesting is that Romania had entered into a military support agreement with Ukraine a couple of years ago, because Ukraine has been blocked from joining NATO and needs this additional support, right? And so there is like this deep relationship between Romania and Ukraine, and it was the Conservative Party that was backing away from that and insisting that in some way Ukraine reimburse Romania for the funds and support that it's provided to Ukraine. I think that the Romanian people object to that approach, and that their response in the elections has more to do with that relationship than maybe we're seeing in the headlines.
And also it's in Romania's interest to make sure that the Ukrainians can defend themselves, because they know that if they don't and they can't, then they may well be next.
Libby?
Well, I just want to say a friend of mine just texted me.
Brag.
This little, huh?
That you've got friends and they're texting you?
Yes,
brag.
Yes. We went to college together. That we have to remember that Russia is on the Security Council in the UN. And so if we're looking for anything out of that body, it's not going to happen. So yeah. It's going to be up to individual countries who value democracy to rally around the flag.
Jim?
Yeah, I mean, people have been calling for a long time for reform of the UN and reform of the Security Council. I mean, the UN doesn't do anything on its own. It is a function of the member states that make up the UN, and particularly on issues like this, the members of the Security Council and the permanent members have veto power. So obviously that's not a venue where any kind of serious peacemaking is going to be done with Russia on the Security Council, as Libby said.
panel@wamc.org to join the conversation. We are just about out of time this morning. Our panel has been Senior Fellow at the Bard Center for Civic Engagement, Jim Ketterer, Political Consultant and Lobbyist, Libby Post, and Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel. Opinions her own. Opinions all your own, really, but Nick has been instructed to qualify that. Opinions her own. Panel@wamc.org if you'd like to give us any feedback on the show. Of course, all of our programs are posted online at wamc.org. In the 11 o'clock hour, we will be sharing a special with you. It is a Call to Mind special from American Public Media for Mental Health Awareness Month entitled Treating the Young Mind. We will be airing that from 11 to noon this morning. And up next, shortly, after a few minutes, we will hear Lockbox Fundraising with Ray Graff and David Gastina. Thank you, everybody, for being here this morning. Appreciate you as ever.
Thank you.
They're nodding.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. Yes. WAMC.org to keep the locked box going, and you will be hearing from Ray and David shortly.